Happy New Year, everybody. Glad to be back. Computers, believe it or not, and it took a lot longer to do what we wanted to do, but needless to say, we're running Windows 7. A little operating system corruption, so we felt, why not? In any event, we decided to take a couple of weeks off. We ran some rebroadcasts. You should have enjoyed them. And it's a little frigid, but probably not as frigid as many of you are in other places of this fine country of ours. But we're really glad to be back. It's exciting to be back live. I love to do this show. And last year was our first year, and we're starting off the this year a little bit different in that we're going to kind of take each week as they come. We tried to do a lot of scheduling in advance last year and had to do a lot of, they're telling me that I'm having a little sound problem. I don't know what that might be. See what is going on.
Hold on, folks. I'm sorry. We don't know what's going on right now, but the internet connection between us and Susan is fading in and out. We're going to be right back. Don't go anywhere.
All right. Well, here we go. I guess Mercury in retrograde is affecting us all, and maybe my upgrade to Windows 7 didn't work so good. This is the first time I've done the show trying to use Windows 7, so I guess we need to do some more testing. In any event, we are back, and again, it's a new year, and as I was saying, we're going to be doing some things a little bit differently in that our schedule is going to be done kind of as we go, because we found that trying to pre-schedule things in advance was getting a little bit hairy and things weren't quite working out. But I wanted to start this year off, with a little bit of, I guess really trying to bring the whole concept of genealogy and healing and how, really genealogy can have a healing effect on people's lives, and especially when they're traumatic events. You know, as I've mentioned over the many months, I've been doing some, taking on caseloads. And one of the caseloads that I took on back in August started off very benign, I must say. And it was someone who was looking for his mother's grave. And the story that I was initially told was that she had committed suicide and that nobody really knew where she was buried. So in a very benign sort of way, I said, great, I took the project. And in my inimitable way, I asked the client, I said, are there any stories that, I might need to know that might help me put the pieces of this puzzle together? And it was very interesting because I did get an email from the client. And he's on the line with me today, and his name is Fred, and we're going to forego last names because when you hear some of the things that surround this story, I think you might understand why. But I get a letter, and the email starts off, and I'm going to read it because it's a very compelling letter that I got, and you can imagine my surprise. I pretty much fell out of my chair. I hate to say it. I had goosebumps. It was a very, very emotional piece, and it read something like this. My mother murdered my brother and my sister before killing herself. Word is, I was next on the chopping block. Well, you can imagine those were pretty compelling words to get. All I was doing was looking for a grave of an individual. So I keep reading, and it keeps going on, and it goes like this. I've found this to be a somewhat unusual situation in Jewish families at the time, the early 1940s. Usually what happened to the firstborn male in such families is that he was doted on. okay, the second kid, maybe she's a pain and the you know what. So you let her drown and claim you fainted. But never the first kid. And the third? Well, that would be me. It turns out, according to all who were alive at the time and familiar with the events, it was me or her. So by killing herself, she saved my life. How weird is that? I had no idea when I began this journey. I had no idea I had a brother and a sister. I had known that my mother had committed suicide when I was just a few weeks old, but I thought it was because I was demanding the same level of female attention I do to this day, causing enormous exasperation. It turns out it may not have even been me. The woman was in the midst of at least her third psychological meltdown, equal to the number of children she gave birth to. The thought that she didn't want kids has occurred to me. Today we might refer to the cause of these tragedies as postpartum depression, and I suppose the well-educated would definitely call it that. I don't know what or how they classified these types of over-the-top reactions of this sort way back then, but would be the early 1940s, quite back in that day. To my best of my knowledge, my mother was never arrested or prosecuted or any form of child abuse, nor was she treated for any sort of psychological disorder. Fred, that was a very compelling letter that you sent to me. And, you know, we started on this journey together, and this was back in August. Is that right?
That's right, yeah.
Yeah. And at that time, the letter went on to say that you had heard about these things, but you had thought that your mother really had died of pneumonia.
Well, when I was 11 and my stepmother died, I was a little older, actually, because it was a while after my stepmother died, but my father told me that I had a birth mother, that the mother that I was mourning at that time was actually my stepmother. And he told me that she died of pneumonia, which is what I believed for the next 25 years or so.
And, you know, you went
so,
on.
Yeah, I was... I'm sorry.
Go ahead.
So I was fundamentally misinformed, and I did find out about her having committed suicide in a somewhat unusual way. Should I go through?
Oh yeah,
through that
me too.
As well?
I think that I wanted you to tell the rest of the story. So you were, what, about 35?
Well, I was about 35, maybe a little bit older, but it was about 25 years or so later. So I had gone through getting married and having two children, moving to Colorado, living life as, you know, people lived life during the 70s and 80s, and that is I was in the midst of getting a divorce. And one evening, my then wife and I were in the midst of an argument, pretty much about nothing, I'm pretty sure, as these things are. And she, during the argument, blurted out that perhaps I should kill myself the way my mother did.
Oh, boy.
And that put an abrupt end to the argument because I was shocked, to say the least. I didn't understand what she was talking about. And I asked her how she knew, and she said that in a very civil way, of course, you can imagine. she said that my cousin Bobby, who was probably the keeper of all the family information at that time, that Bobby had told her early on in our marriage that that my mother had committed suicide and did not die of pneumonia. But nonetheless, this was not a topic of conversation that my wife and I had at any time until that sort of fateful argument. So I went home that night. I was living in a little apartment. My wife and I were separated, and called my father, who confirmed that that was indeed the case, that she had committed suicide. He didn't give me any other information other than to say that she had been treated for some sort of mental disorders. I wasn't in good enough shape at that time. I was probably imbibing a bit, to really question him. And given all the other things that had gone on, this was sort of a dagger in the relationship between my father and I, probably ending any kind of meaningful discussions that we'd have from that point on. I went along, you know, I now had to essentially process the fact that my mother had committed suicide. She had done it when I was 5 weeks old, that there had to have been some sort of relationship between my birth and her death. You know, I still had two kids. I was still working very hard. I still had a life to lead, and I didn't really process it very much. And I was seeing a psychiatrist at the time, and he essentially said, you know, this is a generation, my father's, of people who keep secrets, who don't give you all the information. And you know, I that's certainly been borne out over the years in things that I've discovered in talking to friends my age, that they certainly did they protected their kids by not giving them any information.
Right.
So that's what I had, and I just went along with that for the longest time. And then my cousin Bobby, the same cousin who had told Marilyn about the suicide a long, long time ago, early in our marriage, my first wife,
right.
She contracted breast cancer. And she lived in New York, and I went and visited her, and I go to New York quite frequently. We had dinner, and she told me that before her mother died, that her mother had told her that I had a sibling who had died before me, and that the sibling, whose gender she did not know, she thought had drowned when my mother was bathing.
Okay.
Because we didn't know at that time if it was a him or a her. Well, once again, I was in shock. Once again, I went on with my life. I didn't pause to really process this the way I should. And then in April of this year, or last year, actually in April 2009, I was back in New York, and for the first time in about 20 years or more, I went to Brooklyn, to the Brooklyn Museum. And it's very odd, but, I walked around, I had this feeling that not of deja vu, or just that things were stirring, and suddenly memories came back to me. And it was, I realized, you know, it sounds very strange, but I was sort of hit in the face with memories that I had so successfully repressed for all these many years, because I had lived in Brooklyn in a foster home. After my stepmother died, it was a very, very difficult experience. And I just put it out of my mind. So it all came flooding back during that trip to the Brooklyn Museum. And I decided I needed to know more. And at that time, I had the time, and I started to look into these things. It's a very, very difficult process to look into this from my point of view.
Absolutely.
Not being a terrible, what's that?
I said absolutely. I mean, this, you
yeah.
know, I mean, the whole story,
well,
and having it said, you know, in bits and pieces, you know, I mean, it's very, you know, it's a very difficult thing to deal with. And then, you know, once you make the decision that you want to know the answers, you know, it becomes a little bit more difficult in trying to go out and find those as well.
Yeah, that's true. And but the process itself is difficult. And because I didn't know where to look, I didn't have any information really to go on. I didn't. I kept on running into brick walls and having to start, you know, sort of go back and start again and run into another brick wall and continue to do that. And it became very frustrating, although I would get every now and then little pieces of information, for instance.
Right. And that really is the,
I did find.
That's the process of genealogy, is
yeah.
that, you know, you do hit brick walls sometimes, and probably more times than not. And then suddenly some bits and pieces of information, you know, pop up, and, you know, there are clues, and then you have to proceed with those clues. But, yeah, that's really the whole process of genealogy, to be perfectly honest.
Right. And it takes a patient person to be able to deal with that, somebody who could deal with the frustration.
Right.
And not only deal with the frustration, and this is probably a little advertisement for you, Susan, but can deal with it from an unemotional, uninvolved platform. Because when you're involved in this, it does, there is a big emotional impact when you find out things. For instance, when I found out that, when I first saw an article in a newspaper archive from Syracuse, New York, that my mother had lost two sons, and there was an article in the paper about it, I was shocked. I was absolutely shocked because I didn't know that there were two. And I almost shut everything down at that point because it was so impactful.
Right.
And I knew I couldn't really do a whole lot more. And that's when I contacted Susan and started to get the help I needed to find out more.
And, you know, from a researcher's perspective, you know, believe it or not, we tend to take on some of the emotional baggage that you know, some of these stories come with. You know, I remember, you know, when I first started to work on the project with Fred, you know, one of the first things that I was able to find was, believe this or not, was a newspaper article similar to the one that he had found in the Syracuse, New York paper, but it happened to be in the Galveston, Texas paper. And in this particular article, it actually, I think, identified for the first time the names of these two siblings, which up to that point, not only did he not know, right, Fred, that you had, you know, first one, it was a shock, then two, you know, and from a researcher's perspective, you know, when I found those, I mean, I had, you know, goosebumps, and, you know, I wanted to make sure that I gave that information to him right away. And, you know, all I could say when I sent the article is, I am so sorry. I mean, it was just, you know, very impactful to know that we were uncovering something that, A, was very new information, and B, that really we're putting names to people and to babies that, left this earth in some very traumatic ways. And, you know, Fred being really the lone survivor of all these siblings, you know, I knew that the impact on him was going to be stressful. And, you know, I just felt, I felt terrible. I felt happy and terrible at the same time, Fred, having to share that information with you. So, once we did that, and once we had the names of these two children, you know, we were able to go and get their death certificates, which in turn led us very quickly to the cemetery with which they were buried. And you want to tell us the story of your trip to New York?
I did go to the cemetery to visit my brother and sister's grave. And I have to just add to what Susan said a minute ago about when she emailed that article to me from the Galveston, of all places, newspaper with the names in it. That it became reality to me. Before, it was academic. You know, it was something going on. I did want to do the research. I was curious. But when I got the names, the impact was that reality had hit me in the face. So I did want to pursue it further. And I did, I went to Syracuse to visit my mother's grave because, curiously, even though she died in New York City, she was buried in Syracuse. And I had been to her grave once before, but it was early after my stepmother died, and I was sort of in a haze. I wasn't aware of what was going on, so I was like 12 years old. So I went again this time to Syracuse and visited her grave and kind of felt a connection that I had never felt before. I then went back to New York City where my brother and sister are buried in a cemetery in Queens and visited their graves. And that was enormously emotional, very, very solemn kind of experience because I had a brother and a sister that I didn't even know who were lying there in these little infant graves, that, shouldn't have been there. So at that point I was also convinced that during these depression meltdowns, the postpartum depression incidents that my mother had, that she had purposefully murdered those two children. So, and I was well aware at that time when I visited those graves that had they lived, I would not have, because of the ages. So I don't think I would have been born, for instance, had my brother lived. Or I would have been born later and in a different form, you know, I wouldn't have been who I am.
Right.
So that in itself was pretty emotional. The graves were not in great shape. They were, you know, tended to, but not in a, at a high level. You have to pay extra. Nobody had paid any attention to these graves for ages. And I'm talking about, you know, like 60 years or more. They were in, you know, they were overgrown with some ivy. They were, they had these little things on them that looked like snails that I had to kind of knock off. I then arranged for those graves to be better maintained than, they had been over those years. And the thought occurred to me as I was talking to them, and, you know, telling my sister how I missed her and what a great pain in the neck she would have been had she lived, because I could envision my being born in the same form I am now, had she lived, and she would have been 3 years older and, you know, an older sister. Right. And I imagine the king-size pain in the neck. And I would have loved to have had that. I told my brother that I was, you know, really sorry that he was dead and I was alive, and that he must be pretty upset with me that I'm standing there and he's lying there. It was, as I said, not a rational experience.
Wow.
So I left there very impacted by that experience, and curious again what went on with me after my mother died, after my birth mother, whose name is Lillian, was Lillian, died.
So even after, you know, when we talked earlier too, you mentioned something to me about, you know, some future thoughts about what you've actually thought about doing and you know, with those two graves. And, you know, that all kinds of things pop into your mind, you know, because if I recall, the graves are not next to each other, right?
The two kids died 15 months or so apart, and so they're buried in separate subsections of the cemetery in different rows. And their graves are a little bit difficult to find. And my thought was that I should have them buried together. And it's even occurred to me to have them come out here to Colorado and be buried here, where I will be at some point. I don't know if I want to disturb them. I just, you know, it's something that I never thought I would be thinking about.
Yeah.
You know, it's just not a topic that comes up. But I do think about it, and I'm sure at some point when I'm more emotionally accustomed to this idea, I will look into, you know, what the costs of that will be.
Right. And you know, too, that when the time's right, the answer will come. And you'll know what to do.
Right.
You know, and like you said,
right.
You know, a little bit more, you know, time passing and, you know, proceeding with the healing. You know, I have to laugh because I remember when, you know, we first started to communicate, you went and looked at my website and you came back and asked me, he says, you know, are you a genealogist or are you a healer? I'll never forget that. And I had to laugh and I said, no, I'm not, I'm a genealogist. You know, that's my trade, but, you know, I definitely believe that genealogy has some incredible healing qualities. And in some cases, you know, when you go through something like what Fred does, I mean, it's it does take time to heal. It's not an immediate healing, I don't suspect. I mean, the truth, no matter how difficult it is, and as we can see, this is, you know, quite a difficult, traumatic you know, situation to not live in the truth and not know the truth until you're 66 years old. I think that's what you told me you were. And,
right.
You know, the healing as it is progressing, I mean, you know, we started this in April. You know, we made most of the findings in August, I believe. And from August till now, you visited New York, you know, the New York and the cemeteries and, you know, have, in some respects, asked for forgiveness, I think is what I heard, and maybe gave some forgiveness to your mother, which is all part of the healing process. But, you know, that was part one of the project. Part two of the project, I think, yeah, it was a little bit happier than this one, although difficult, I'm sure. But your mother had a brother and a sister, if I remember correctly. And the sister apparently died young, younger.
In a car.
But, yeah, but the brother did survive, and we had an idea that he may have been living in Michigan, and if I recall, it took us a couple of death certificates to find the right one because the name was not an unusual name. And once we found the death certificate, it became very, from my point of view, doing what I do, we were very quickly able to identify the descendants of Lillian's brother. And, you know, we found them out in California. And this kind of got a little traumatic, too, and I'm going to jump a little bit ahead of you, and then I'm going to let you tell some of the story, is that I was able to find these descendants, and I emailed them, or I think I suggested that you email them, didn't I, Fred? Or I emailed them.
You did, and I...
And then I think you
I sent the initial, I sent the initial email, which was totally, I tried to be so totally innocuous, and unthreatening, and then we didn't get an answer.
Yeah, and that was a very traumatic weekend, if I remember correctly, and
Right.
Remember, I just said, let's just have a little patience, you know, and, you know, if we don't hear from them by such and such a date, then, you know, maybe I'll email them. And it was quiet. We hadn't heard anything. And finally, I think I did send an email. And, you know, Fred's initial, thoughts was, you know, they don't want any part of me. They don't want to talk to me. They don't want to, you know, have anything to do with me. They know the story of my family, yada, 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 yada. And we finally got a response, and I'm going to let you pick up the story from there.
Well, the email went to the daughter of my cousin, the cousin that I was looking for.
Right.
And and she had a completely different last name, and I'm not sure exactly how Susan found her, but we found my cousin's daughter. And through her daughter, I found my cousin. And I then spoke to her on the phone, and she relayed to me the story that her mother, who had died in 1990, had told her about me. First of all, she was astounded that I had done this, that I had found her. And she just couldn't believe that, you know, I had popped up again in her life. Because the last time she saw me, she was 3 years old. She's now, and that was when I was born, so she's older than I am by 3 years.
Okay.
And, after my mother, after Lillian died, my father essentially shipped me off to, Michigan to live with my mother's brother and his wife and, this cousin. I did live there for about 6 months, and at which point that family gave my father an ultimatum, essentially telling him that he either had to come get me, bring me back from Michigan, or they were going to adopt me. So he went and got me, which is why I grew up in New York and why I didn't know my cousin or anything about her. After we found her, there was an immediate connection. I mean, really, a strong bond. Almost, it was like love before first sight or something. It was incredible bond. And I did go out to Los Angeles, where she lives, to meet her. And that was intense. She and her two children were there. They were in the front seat of the car, and I was waiting at the turnaround to the hotel. And she got out of the back seat and hugged me, and I mean, I truly felt like I was home. I mean, it was just an incredible feeling to have reconnected with this person after all these years, and having, you know, essentially a family again that I could call my own, that makes, you know, that has real bloodlines to me.
And ties to them.
Pardon me?
And ties to your past. I mean, really, other than, you know, I mean, your immediate family, you know, does not really tie you to your past. This was really
My father's family sort of, my father's family sort of threw up his hands, their collective hands, and I haven't seen or spoken to them in years and years. My stepmother's family has also stepped out of the scene and won't come back into it. My real mother's family, I have cousins, that I keep in touch with, but they're you know, distant cousins, fourth cousins. They're not, close cousins, not first cousins. So this is on my mother's side, the only first cousin I have, and she has a sister, Shari, who I haven't met yet, who lives in Michigan, and I plan to meet her next time she's in Los Angeles. I'll fly out again for a little group hug of that group. So it's been just eye-opening.
So, you know, today, having gone through, I mean, that's a lot to go through in 4 months. There's no question about it. You know, and the story is a story of extreme, you know, lows and extreme highs. But, you know, I mean, when you really add it all up and you look at, you know, where you were in April, for example, and where you are now, how would you describe the difference in how you feel and you know how you perceive things? I think, I mean, it's probably has some very broad reaching effects.
It does have broad reaching effect for sure, and you know, one of the differences for me, and I don't know if everyone would feel this way, is that I no longer feel quite as alone as I felt before. And I have 3 children and 5 grandchildren, who I see quite a bit. I mean, they live not, you know, within an hour from me. So I see them a lot. But nonetheless, you know, I didn't feel a connection to a sort of, I don't know, if you look at the chart, they're the lower part of the chart. And so I have a great connection with that lower part, but I didn't have any connection with the upper part. And, now I do, and it does help, you know, kind of, it not only adds people, but it adds a dimension that is close. I mean, it's a close connection rather than the sort of distant one that I had. And then there's definitely some holes that are filled. I mean, you know, there's lots of things that I still have quite a bit of question about. There's no one around who can answer these questions. These are not questions that would be in any records anywhere. So it's opened a lot of, doors to questions that, you know, I'm now convinced I'll never find the answers to, although I will continue to search. You know, it's given me also, a story that I want to write about at some point because I think it is though not unique, it's at least compelling, and if I can make a good story of it, I think it might be interesting at least for my family to read and maybe others.
Right. So, you know, what would be your recommendation if you know, there are people in the audience who have, you know, a skeleton like this in their closet that they've, you know, have chosen to, I guess in your words, repress. You know, what would be, you know, your words of wisdom to, you know, after going through this process of, you know, learning some truths and hard ones and, you know, I mean, even when you were retelling the story, I had tears come back in my eyes as I had during most of the process of working with you on this, which, you know, is I guess par for the course for those of us who see genealogy in a very intense and internal way. What would be your words of wisdom?
Well, to begin with, if there has been tragedy in your life and you've repressed it, then unrepressing it is not for the faint of heart. It takes a good deal of courage, I think, to face your own personal tragedies and to deal with all of the emotional impact that it has. And especially if those tragedies have been to people who are close to you, or were close to you. It really has, for me, it was, you know, as I've said throughout this, it's been very impactful, it's been very emotional, it's been very saddening in a lot of ways. But as I've also said, it filled a bunch of holes. It made me realize more of who I was and what was happening to me. My cousin, the one in Los Angeles, asked me at one time how I got to be so normal. To some extent, reasonably successful. And I sent her this note. I'd like to, so we have time. It's
sure.
I don't know, four paragraphs if there's time to, I'd like to read you this one. This is the thank you note that I sent to the family after I came back from Los Angeles. And it says, I'm in my study in the thin, looking at a thin layer of snow on the trees and mountains, reflecting on one of the most extraordinary weekends of my life. The mountains are magnificent when there's snow on their peaks, and it's all set against a vivid blue Colorado sky. But nothing compares to meeting and spending some time with all of you this past weekend. For me, it closes a big hole in my life. I'm aware of how cliche that sounds, but I can't think of a better way to phrase it. Though I would like to know every detail of my early life, I'm content with what I know and resigned to what I don't. You asked me how I turned out as I did, given all the trauma and abandonment endured during the early years of my life. I've thought about that, and I believe I know. First, I had a very loving stepmother who put me on a pedestal and maintained her expectations of me until the day she died. Second, I have good genes. I learned that this weekend. So between the environment and the genes, I turned out okay. As my cousin and I discussed, we'll never know what percent was genetic and what was environmental, but in the end, who cares? I'm sure that luck had a role in this too, but I'm discounting it. I know it must be nauseating to hear me say it so often, but thank you for all the wonderful things you did for me this weekend. I love you all. Freddie. They're the only people in the world who call me Freddie.
Wow. So, you know, looking back, would you do it all over again?
Oh, I would in a heartbeat.
In a heartbeat.
I mean, I think that, yeah, I think that there's a I think you feel compulsed to do this, if you have even a modicum of curiosity about yourself and where you came from. And you don't know. I mean, if you had parents like mine who never tell you anything and you want to know things, then I think you've got to go through this process. I mean, it's hard. It is a little bit draining, but at the same time, I do think it's important to know.
Well, I'm going to tell you,
recommend it.
It was draining on the genealogist too. It was really amazing. I remember in most of the letters emails you just send to me, wow, that was quick. I'm going to tell you something. I think Lillian was hanging over my shoulder telling me where to go. She wanted this for you. I don't know where I came up with some of these, places that I ended up going to where we were, you know, just pieces puzzled together so quickly. And I stand convinced that your mom was sitting over my shoulder just saying, go here, go there, do this, do that. I really believe, because
I'll tell you, Susan.
It was incredible.
Yeah. Well, there were probably 6 months ago, I wouldn't have believed that, you know, that there was a guardian angel or anything like that. I mean, my background is science. I'm not a touchy-feely kind of person. So which is why I asked you the question early on, are you a genealogist or a healer? Because I really wanted a genealogist, but I didn't get a healer.
Now I'm a touchy-feely genealogist.
I'm glad that I did. Pardon me?
But I'm a touchy-feely genealogist.
A touchy-feely genealogist.
I guess in
some... So, yeah, I'm...
You can call me an empath because, you know, I felt your pain and I felt the family's pain, but I felt your happiness too. And, you know, I can't tell you, you know, how privileged I have felt to have been able to participate in this journey with you. And it's one that I don't think I'll ever forget. It's one that will remain, you know, as part of me, you know, for the rest of my life, from the minute I got that email, that first letter where the first sentence spelled out, you know, things that I had absolutely no idea that, you know, I was going to be reading. So, you know, the shock that you were in was definitely relayed and became shock to me. And from a researcher's point of view, I mean, it was almost a mission to fulfill, you know, and to get you those answers because, I mean, it was just one of those compelling stories that you don't run into every day. And I think that, you know, being a part of that journey with you has been, you know, something very sacred for me as well. So I want you to know that. I'll never forget it. Not in a million years.
Well, I appreciate that. And I also appreciate all the help that you provided because I, quite frankly, yes, I was always surprised about how quickly you found the answers, but I was even more surprised that you found the answers. So I appreciate that. And I know that I couldn't have gone down half this road, had I not had the kind of help that I had. And,
well,
and so I truly do appreciate the assistance.
Well, thank you very much. And, you know, that's, you know, why I want to do this work, you know, and that's kind of lead me into a close. It really is why I really want to do this work because it has not only an impact on somebody else and as you can tell and see from, you know, Fred's story, it has some incredible healing qualities. And not only to Fred, but to me as well. You know, my mother was adopted and went to her grave with abandonment issues. And, you know, I inherited some of those abandonment issues that I, too, have had to work through. So, you know, there's healing all around, I think, no matter what role one plays in the story. I am sure that the people who participated in your cousins out in Los Angeles have experienced some healing as well, and you know, probably not in the same way that you did, Fred, but in such a way. And I'd be very interested one day to hear how your wife feels about all of this and some of perhaps some changes that may be, you know, taking place within you and maybe some of these touchy-feely things that you may not have exhibited in the past that you may be exhibiting now that, you know, may be very, very good qualities as you move through the next years, I think. It's a beautiful thing. So I thank you so much, Fred, for coming on and sharing this story. I know it was tough to do. I know that we've talked about it for months, and, you know, it's a very, tough thing to talk about, the trauma that you experienced and this family experienced and how that affected you, and I really appreciate you taking the time. So thank you very much.
It's been an experience.
Yes, it has. In any event, this has been Where Genealogy and Spirit Connect. As you can see from this past hour, there is a place for both. And I'm Susan King. You can find me at www.susaneking.com. We'll be back next week with another show. And until then, stay warm, and we'll see you then.